From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
a political legend in Arkansas dies. We'll have a look back at the life of former Senator and Governor Dale Bumpers.
A big news week for the Affordable Care Act on the state and congressional levels.
The Little Rock School District moves forward with plans for two new schools.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
For the week ending Friday, January 8th, 2016, this is KUAR's Weekend Review Podcast. While a memorial service is set for Sunday for former Governor and Senator Dale Bumpers, we'll take a look back at his life coming up here toward the end of the program. But first, Jacob, wanted to start with you. The governor had a media availability this week. Among other things, he said that two key issues that are pending, changes to the state's Medicaid expansion program and an increase in highway funding, he says he wants both to be considered in one special session. But first, talk about his plans for the Medicaid expansion, what has been known as the private option, but now becomes Arkansas Works.
And for it to become Arkansas Works, the governor wants some changes to happen to Medicaid expansion, things like requiring some people to pay premiums, maybe requiring some sort of work requirement. You have to go to work referral trainings. But the governor did, he submitted a letter to federal officials asking for some of these changes, previewing that he will officially be sending a waiver application in the spring of 2016. Hopefully we'll have some legislative action by then as well. And so he sent that letter, and so it is expected reforms. Some of them are aspirational. He doesn't think he'll be able to get them, probably, like requiring people to work to get Medicaid coverage. That's just something that's not the purpose of Medicaid. He was pressed a little bit about what some of his must-haves might be.
Once we formulate more of the details, we'll know which ones are make or break. Each of those principles are essential, in my judgment. We are going to accomplish greater work responsibility and requirements. We're going to insist upon a more personal responsibility. We're going to insist upon more program integrity that's been outlined. We'll see where the discussions go with Secretary.
But there are a lot of those must-haves and some of these waiver requests, conservative reforms that federal officials for other states have kind of drawn a red line in the sand saying, no, you can't require certain things out of this Medicaid program. So the governor said, we'll see what we wind up with. And so for some state lawmakers like Terry Rice, he resigned from the health care task force this week. He will not be traveling with the governor and legislative leaders to Washington next month, which the governor announced during this press conference. He resigned from the committee. These are the kind of reforms he doesn't think are really conservative.
I have not supported Obamacare. I have opposed the private option. I think it will collapse in time. It would be an improvement to what came out of Washington, D.C., but I wouldn't say it works for me.
And state lawmakers had a lot to react to from Washington this week as well. In Congress, for the first time, sent a repeal of the Affordable Care Act to the president's desk, which he vetoed this week, as expected. The governor kind of addressed that vote before the president vetoed it.
I would expect any legislation that would end the Affordable Care Act would deal with a transition for the 30-some states that have Medicaid expansion as to how you unwind that. It's not something that you do abruptly. It's something that would take some time to do, and you'd have to manage that process.
And the governor also mentioned that he does now have a meeting set with the Health and Human Services Director, Sylvia Burwell, to discuss these proposed changes. He'll be joined by House Speaker Jeremy Gillum, Senate President Pro Tem Jonathan Dismeng, as well as the Surgeon General, Greg Bledsoe. Did he say anything about what he expects to happen at that meeting, whether or not the federal government will be amenable to these proposed changes?
No, and that was kind of that first cut that I played, that he wouldn't identify any must-haves other than saying that we must have the general principles of my reforms kind of solidified. But as far as the particulars, he's kind of mentioned before, he thinks that requiring asset testing probably won't happen because it doesn't happen in traditional Medicaid, but he's going to ask for it. He wants premiums for people who make up to 50% of the federal poverty level, and the federal government in the past has said, well, you're requiring people who are too poor to pay premiums, so probably not that, but maybe we'll let you pay for 100% federal poverty level or above. So, he wants to express some confidence here. He doesn't know quite what he's going to get, but one of the things that he was talking about, that he wanted to transition from the Affordable Care Act, if there is something else, and part of that is what federal officials will allow and what they won't allow. But let me get into Representative Bruce Westerman, who also spoke with House leadership, and he didn't offer a replacement for Medicaid expansion, which is what the governor's been talking about.
This bill does repeal Medicaid expansion. This is one of the most egregious parts of Obamacare. If you look at traditional Medicaid, it's for the aged, blind, and the disabled. Medicaid expansion is for able-bodied, working-age adults.
And so that's the fundamental thing he'll be arguing with Secretary Burwell, as you mentioned, is that Hutchinson wants able-bodied, working adults to have some kind of conditions to get insurance. Representative Westerman clearly does not want them to have insurance through the federal government. And I also spoke with Senator Tom Cotton. He also got to act in this kind of legislative leadership role. Westerman gave his remarks next to House Speaker Ryan. Senator Cotton got to act as Senate President pro tem and officially send the bill, the repeal bill, to the president's desk. And he also acknowledged that this repeal bill does not have any solutions to replace Obamacare, as he calls it. But he said in the future, maybe they would try to address the new enrollees in Medicaid.
What I would like to see is a lot of the strings and the red tape of Medicaid cut, so Governor Hutchinson and our legislature can work to address the needs not only of the new Medicaid recipients, but also all the people who have been on Medicaid for years in Arkansas.
So Cotton, like Governor Hutchinson, said that the real reforms that they really want, the conservative reforms, probably won't be possible with this president, probably won't be possible with Secretary Burwell. So they both point to 2017, see this veto as kind of a way to frame the election, hoping they can get a Republican president who might free them up to do things with Medicaid that the Obama administration simply won't. And this is Governor Hutchinson, though. He went as far to say that until we have a new president, there can't be any, quote, serious solutions to be found for this. He probably didn't mean to suggest that his Arkansas work solutions weren't serious, but this is what he said.
Well, I don't think we would have difficulty here in Arkansas in getting great unity in terms of where we go with our Medicaid population if you had a state block grant type of approach where we could put work requirements, not just work referral requirements, but more serious requirements in place.
So next month, when the governor and legislative leaders return, we'll know a little bit more about what he thinks he can get out of this. But the legislature is expected to vote on these proposed reforms before they even know what will be approved from federal officials in the spring.
And this comes as the state's going to have to be picking up part of the tab for this Medicaid expansion, paying 5% starting in 2017, with that increasing up to 10% by 2020. Did he discuss that or the concerns as the state actually starts having to pick up part of this cost?
Yeah, and that's been one of the governor's big central focuses going forward, is that if we continue Medicaid expansion, one of his conditions is the state must save money elsewhere from the traditional Medicaid program. However, the Stevens Group report notes that even when the state in 2021 is contributing 10%, the private option still saves Arkansas money on the whole, and that is if you just got rid of it. So it's kind of a dubious argument to some, at least, that you really need to cut money elsewhere to pay for this.
And Jacob, you mentioned that the governor is looking at asset testing and premiums for up to 50% of the population on Medicaid. And he also mentioned in his cuts something about work requirements and work referral requirements. If the feds approve some kind of work requirement for folks on for a certain percentage of Medicaid, what would the state do under Hutchinson's plan to help people find work if they don't already have it?
Well, at this point, I think the governor has decided that just straight up requiring work to get the benefits if you're able-bodied is off the table, because it's not happened elsewhere. It's not going to happen in Medicaid. That's their ideal. That's what they hope will happen with the Ted Cruz presidency, perhaps. But what they want to do is have a work training referral. So if you get Medicaid, the Department of Workforce Services or someone like that sends you some sort of job training program. One of the finer points might be, can they require you to actually show up to the training or not? And nobody knows.
And the other key issue that the governor is wanting to address is highway funding. He said he's going to issue recommendations by January 19th. What did he say about what he's considering at this point? The state has to contribute a certain amount for the federal government to give Arkansas money for highways. The state has to contribute, I forget, 20 or 30%. And the governor has said he clearly doesn't want to miss out on that federal money. So how is he looking to make up for the shortfall that has been coming as vehicles are getting better mileage and we're not getting the revenue needed out of the existing gas tax?
And that is how he framed it in those remarks to the reporters, at least, is that with the federal money coming in, the state has to match it to a certain point if they want to get that money. No real big news here. It's this, Chris, I think you've covered a lot, the governor's highway working group, that people he appointed from industry, state leaders, some legislators as well. And they had, I think, five different recommendations. The governor's big thing is it has to be revenue neutral. And what revenue neutral means can mean different things to different people. It could mean taking from education or taking from pre-K or something like that to pay for highways. It could mean that they raise a new tax. They still could raise a new tax, but that would mean they'd have to lower a tax somewhere else in the budget. So the governor, you know, he won't commit firmly to anything at this point, but he's looked at those five recommendations. He wants it to be revenue neutral.
Yeah, I believe in a statement last year, he expressed maybe a little bit of dissatisfaction with proposals that would include tax increases. But a lot of those proposals from that working group that he commissioned do involve tax increases, either by indexing the gas tax to inflation, or there was one kind of novel proposal to tax based on miles traveled for a vehicle or reported miles traveled, to try to keep up with this kind of falling revenue as more and more vehicles gain greater efficiency and don't use as much gas and consumption goes down, therefore revenue is going down.
But out of this, for the first time, the more exciting news about how they might fund highways is that they might take from general revenue for the first time to pay for it, which would be a new way to get funding for the highway department.
Now, did he mention anything about a potential special session to consider these proposals, or would this be upcoming in a year?
No, it was in the special session. We have the fiscal sessions coming up soon, and then he wanted to have a special session to talk about both Medicaid and the highways. He said he would be open to having two separate ones, but he'd hope to do it all at once.
Yeah, but I know some of the legislative leaders expressed concern. Senator DeSpang said it would be difficult to do address both issues in 3 days, and he would prefer separate issues. But I suppose if they can reach an agreement, everybody's on board actually before this session begins, and it's just a formality. They get together and then they vote on a prearranged agreement. That's probably the only way this could really happen, but is, I guess, feasible.
Yeah, and they're both really controversial because, you know, even though it's total Republican dominance everywhere in elected government, these are taxes on highways is an issue that divides the Republican Party, and what are you going to do about Medicaid expansion is another one of those.
And I imagine with the legislature convening for the fiscal session for about a month, there'll be ample time to discuss it among the members as well as leadership.
They'll definitely get a better picture, I guess, their budget going into it, what the numbers actually are.
Well, this week, the head of the Little Rock School District announced plans are advancing to open a new middle school out in West Little Rock. This is to be housed in an existing office building and in an adjacent warehouse along Highway 10. And Sarah, you've mainly been covering this. I ended up actually covering the press conference with Superintendent Baker Curris. And maybe first I'll start off with his comments here about this middle school and suggesting that the plan at this point, they're about to close on this building that they can convert into a middle school, planning to close on the deal for $11.5 million, then spend $20 million to convert this building, previously used by Leisure Arts, a publisher of lifestyle and instructional craft publications, convert it into a middle school, first for sixth graders, in the coming school year that would begin in August. Here's Baker Curris's remarks at the announcement on Tuesday.
If you go back to the documentation, which was prepared in conjunction with a contemplated bond issue, you'll see that they had contemplated spending around $48 million on the school. Now, that number might be inflated somewhat by equipment and other things, but if you just go with the smallest number out there, which is $48 million, which was anticipated to be spent on a West Little Rock Middle School, you can then look at what we're contemplating and see the tremendous value that comes out of this potential transaction, which is now taking shape. And that is that we've acquired 23.5 acres of a real estate, or we shall acquire it, with a 70,000 square foot office building and 175,000 square foot warehouse. And we think we can transform that warehouse and that location into a first-class, very, very nice middle school for an additional $20 million on the high side. Maybe less than that, but let's just say it's on the high side, and we spend $11.5 million on the basic real estate, $20 million transforming it into a world-class middle school, and we operate that school, we grow our enrollment, enhance our revenues, and we save, just by that math alone, the difference between $48 million and, say, $31 million, roughly $17 million. And what else do we have when we get through? A 70,000 square foot Class A office building.
And Sarah, part of what he mentioned is that this would help grow enrollment. He said that in particular, middle school, it's been difficult for the district because you have people who live in the areas who aren't actually going to Little Rock public schools. Elaborate here on the importance, why the district feels it's so important going forward in this middle school.
Well, the district gets funds on a per student basis, and it has to make up for the loss of desegregation funds, about $40 million. It's anticipating by the 2017 school year. So West Little Rock is a primarily middle upper class, primarily white neighborhood where a lot of students have been fleeing the Little Rock School District for private schools or schools in the suburbs. So this new facility is Superintendent Curris's hope that he can attract, be competitive with some of those private schools that have been taking students out of the district.
And it comes at a difficult time for the district. It was taken over by the state a year ago for having six failing schools. The school board was dissolved. And it sounds like this is an effort just to rebuild, to perhaps establish faith with the community in the district.
Right. This had been a contentious issue of the school board about where to build new schools, where to invest resources. And of course, there are the six schools in academic distress still that we haven't heard too much about recently. But Baker Curris has been able to promise this middle school in West Little Rock starting right away next year. So he's following through on some of the board's goals to build in advantaged neighborhoods and disadvantaged neighborhoods by also mentioning the Southwest Little Rock High School project that will be a longer term project. But, you know, I guess this is a way to revitalize the district and show some momentum. And yet there's still that lingering problem of all of the higher need areas that are kind of following behind.
Yeah, and I'll play a cut here from Baker Curris talking about that proposed high school on a piece of land that the district has already purchased.
To build a world-class educational facility, a 21st century facility in Southwest Little Rock at a cost of, say, $80 million. And that's on the high side, but $80 million would give us a facility that it would include some things that we may or may not include. That's going to be up to the community, but it's still going to be a world-class educational facility in a part of town that really needs that right now. We have thousands, literally, of students in that area who don't attend in that area. And I can get into that if you want to, but that's the biggest of the big picture. We can do this. It's going to be a challenge financially, but we've got a clear plan to do it.
And this would be an $80 million school, at least that's the estimate, which he said on the high end. But this school would be able to handle about 2,700 students compared to just a little over 1,400 currently enrolled at McClellan and J.A. Fair High Schools. But this would be, it would take several years to make this happen.
Right, and Curris made the argument that those schools could be renovated, but really what the district needs is high-tech, future-looking, new buildings that will attract students. I know you looked at some of the layout plans for the West Little Rock Middle School, and it has a large atrium and some sort of unusual features that that they're showing visually. What more did they say about that?
Well, they think it's first off the architect who's overseeing the planning of this project said just because of the layout, the fact that it does have a lot of open spaces, suggested this is actually surprisingly easy for them to transform into a school. Still, you're looking at about $20 million, but said that this would work surprisingly well as a school. Well, finally, we lost a political legend in Arkansas, a man who, an extremely intelligent man, someone who could speak to political elites on the East Coast in Washington, and could also relate and connect to people in small-town Arkansas. Dale Bumpers, when he first came on the scene and ran for governor against Orville Faubus, a powerhouse, he wasn't given much of a chance, but he ended up coming into the governor's office, completely reworking things there, then went on to the Senate, was actually surprised several people, and just served four terms in the Senate. Was economically, he was fiscally conservative, but in terms of his politics, very liberal, an intellectual, someone who I probably can't even give justice here. I covered him back when I first became a reporter 23 years ago in Little Rock and began covering him then. But I thought maybe we would start off first here by revisiting an interview that he did with KUAR in 2003. This was upon the release of his autobiography called The Best Lawyer in a One-Lawyer Town. He came from Charleston, Arkansas, and thought I'd first here play. This is about a five-minute segment. You know, we don't actually even have this audio anymore, but thankfully C-SPAN was following Senator Bumpers that day as he was making the book tour rounds in Little Rock, and followed him into KUAR. So if you actually want to see this, it is on YouTube. Just search for KUAR and Dale Bumpers, and there it is. But here's a little bit of what he told the late Ron Breeding, who at that time was news and program director for KUAR.
I'm Ron Breeding, FM 89 News. Former Arkansas Governor and U.S. Senator Dale Bumpers is out with a new book. It's a memoir entitled The Best Lawyer in a One-Lawyer Town. Bumpers has been on a series of book signings around the state. He has one this evening at Wordsworth Books in Little Rock, another one coming up at Barnes & Noble. Senator Bumpers, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Ron.
Now, your book details your life experiences from childhood in Charleston over near Fort Smith through the halls of Congress in your most recent career. Let's start off with your childhood. You started in a little bitty town over near Fort Smith, Charleston, Arkansas. What's a pretty colorful town from the book, it seems like.
Well, it is. You know, every town is unique and has its own distinctive features. The name was not distinctive. There are 27 Charlestons in the United States. But during the Depression, everybody was doing everything they could to stay alive. I mean, there was a lot of hunger, terrible unemployment, a lot of illness, no antibiotics, things like that as we know today. It was common for people to die of typhoid fever in the summertime because the water well and the outhouse were within 10 steps of each other. And we slept outside on cots, got bitten by mosquitoes, and got malaria. And the only antidote in those days was quinine. And incidentally, that was the same thing during World War II in the South Pacific. Quinine was the only thing they had. And I had malaria twice before I was 10 years old. So it was a very difficult life, and it was difficult to make ends meet, and a lot of people didn't make ends meet. And my mother was extremely frugal. She just, you know, we couldn't watch the, we couldn't listen to the radio and have the light on at the same time. And we only had meat once a week, and that was a chicken out of my mother's barnyard.
Some of us would like to have maybe seen more about your career as governor and as senator. Is there some reason that you maybe did less on that and more on your formative years?
There really was. I tell you, I probably overdid it, but I studiously avoided anything that could smack of a public policy book. Public policy books just gather dust on the bookshelves. And I could have added a few anecdotes in there about, you know, what shall I say, really dramatic times in the Senate, for example, or being governor. But I was so studiously trying to avoid any hint of a public policy book, I probably overdid it. The New York Times Book Review made that very same point.
Why is it that you think that that a progressive senator, not unlike yourself, it finds it so hard to get elected from the South anymore?
That takes longer than we have on this air, Ron, okay. On this show. But the truth of the matter is, in about 1960, the 11 Confederate states that I mentioned a moment ago, there were 22 Democratic senators. Most of that was a carryover from the Civil War. People had a deep distrust of Republicans because they were considered mostly Yankees, and people in the South felt that we were still living under the yoke of the Civil War. Roosevelt seemed to be the first president ever to recognize that we had rights to and that we were American citizens and to be treated the same as all other American citizens. So slowly but surely, memories dimmed. People forgot. All those old prejudices and so on died away. And the South had always been conservative. Even though the senators, for example, were Democrats, they were all very conservative. And so, as I say, the South remained conservative and the Democratic Party became more liberal. So that's my own explanation for it.
Del Bumper speaking with KUAR's Ron Breeding in 2003. Worth noting, too, that he was considered at one point a serious possible presidential contender. Actually, a few different times he actually talked with people around the country, talked about perhaps money. In particular, in 76, there was talk about him challenging Jimmy Carter for the Democratic nomination to run for president. But in the end, pretty much said he didn't want to subject his family to the rigors of running for president. Also said there were just some health issues that he had. In particular, had some problems with his knee. But he represented Arkansas there, as I said, four terms in the U.S. Senate. And for me, I always appreciated the fact that he could localize any international story. He was extremely intelligent, knew international politics, and you could ask him about anything going on anywhere in the world, and he could give you that analysis. He also didn't mind being called at 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning, which was helpful when I did early mornings in radio back in those days. But perhaps he'll best be remembered, at least nationally, for being the person who made the defense for President Bill Clinton when Clinton was being impeached in the Senate in 1999 to offer a defense of his old friend. It was a time when a lot of Democrats didn't want to have anything to do with Clinton, either politically. They viewed him as toxic after lying about a sexual relationship with a former intern. But Del Bumpers was the one who actually went up on the Senate floor and offered a defense of Clinton. Pretty much said that Clinton had been targeted from even before he took office. You had the Whitewater investigation. You had all kinds of investigations being done by special counsel Ken Starr, as well as his predecessor, Robert Fisk, looking for anything, digging into anything in Clinton's past or his colleagues. You had the Whitewater investigation. You had a lot of Clinton's former business partners, as well as then Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker indicted all of this part of the investigation. But as Bumper said on the Senate floor when he offered a defense, was that none of it ever came to stick to President Clinton, that it took his lie about a sexual relationship to finally lead to his impeachment. And here's a segment of Bumper's from the speech he gave on the Senate floor.
The president suffered a terrible moral lapse, a marital infidelity, not a breach of the public trust, not a crime against society. It is a sex scandal. H.L. Mencken said one time, when you hear somebody say, this is not about money, it's about money. And when you hear somebody say, this is not about sex, it's about sex.
Bumper said, been in poor health for quite a while, but his son said it was a fall in his home back in early December where he broke his hip, and said it was a quick downward spiral from there in terms of his health. And as we record this, the memorial service is set for Sunday at First United Methodist Church in Little Rock. The former president, Bill Clinton, expected to speak, also hearing a lot of other political heavyweights from Washington maybe coming out to attend the service. It will be closed to all but family, friends, and colleagues of the former senator, but it will be streamed live on the web. And we also this week had Bumper's longtime colleague in the Senate, David Pryor, speak. It was during a Legacies and Lunch event hosted by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies at the Central Arkansas Library System, Ron Robinson Theater. He spoke with Skip Rutherford and shared some of his experiences with Bumper's.
This week, you lost a colleague, a very special friend, and as our friend Dan Ferriter, the chancellor at the University of Arkansas, said, Dale Bumper's was someone who gave politics a good name. Would you talk about your friendship and work with Dale Bumper's?
You know, this is awful. I get very emotional about this. In fact, Dale used to tell me, he says, David, you'd break out crying if we dedicated a new washateria sometime. But I get very emotional. I try to get by it. I've got a little role to play in the ceremony on Sunday afternoon. I'm just hoping I don't make a fool out of myself. But at any rate, he was not only my friend, he was our friend. He made Arkansas proud. And Dale probably was one of the most unique political figures that I've ever known anywhere in this state. We had a relationship and a camaraderie and a friendship, and it was bound by a common interest, yes, but just because we liked each other, I guess. I'm flattering myself that he liked me, but I think he did. And he was a special person and a very, very special, warm friend. I loved his confidence. I loved his humor. I loved the things that he stood for. When I say I loved his confidence, he did have a confidence that none of the rest of us seemed to, let's say, exemplify. I'll never forget the great oration he made right after he had left the Senate in the impeachment trial of President Clinton. I called him that night. I told this story many times. I used to tell it around him. But I called him and I said, Dale, that may have been the greatest speech ever given in the United States Senate. He said, I'm inclined to agree with you. And, you know, he was just that way, and that was Dale. And I used to tell the old story about us going to IHOP, Skip, one morning after that speech, and the news people from all over the world were after him to do interviews in London and all over the place, you know, and wanting him to come and speak to this big convention and that convention and whatever, and he turned 99% of that away and turned it down. But we were at IHOP one morning having breakfast, and I noticed, I was looking at over toward the cash register, and there were two waitresses over there, and they were talking, and they were pointing over toward us. And I said, Dale, I think you've been recognized here. And I said, they're going to come over and want your autograph in a minute. So sure enough, here they came. They said, we were having an argument over here at the cash register. Which one of y'all used to be sheriff of Pulaski County? You know, so, you know, we always enjoyed those stories. And then, Skip, we were called on by 8 or 10 groups from time to time to go around the state. We called it kind of the Antique Roadshow. And we're there. We'd go to Russellville and Hot Springs and Fort Smith and all over. We had no notes, no preparation. We just get up there and talk. And we had a lot of fun doing that. I got where when he couldn't think of the punchline for his stories, I could. And vice versa. He would remember mine when I couldn't remember him. But boy, he was special, and we're going to miss him. And he brought honor to our state.
Thank you.
Former Senator David Pryor talking about his longtime colleague. The two served in the Senate together for about 2 decades. And safe to say, Dale Bumper's last of his kind politically. He died at the age of 90. Well, that's it for this week's podcast, the first one of the new year, also our first one in a few weeks after the holiday break. I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
You can find us online at KUAR.org. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and we welcome your comments right to news@KUAR.org. Thanks for listening.